You have seen gas fees be relatively low. Gas fees actually got down to single digits over the last weekend. It will be interesting to see what happens to gas fees after 4844 ships, because something like between 10 to 20x percent of block space is used by layer twos now, like publishing their call data. And basically that's just going away because these shard blobs are going to be in a separate fee market. So all of a sudden you're going to have a bunch of empty space that, you know, can be filled. And the thing about markets like this is that when you get just a little bit of extra demand, it can wildly change the prices of gas. And I do think there is like some demand, like latent demand, which will fill some of that up. But I think it'll be interesting because I think we might also see, you know, people complain about it because, wait, like, we're not burning ETH anymore. And, you know, like, ETH is inflationary again. What is this?
Welcome back to Web3 Builder Show. It's news time, Evan. It's Friday. Got a lot going on today. How are you doing?
It's Friday. Who knew?
Well, we'll be releasing this on Friday, but it's Thursday afternoon for us. But for you, the listener, it's Friday. One quick thing. We're not going to do breaking news every time. And I hid this from you at the beginning because I didn't want to tell you. But SBF is now in jail. And that kind of is similar to what we did last week, right? Talked about him getting arrested. So he's in jail now.
He's officially in jail and cell?
Mm-hmm. In Brooklyn.
I don't really like celebrating people being in jail, but he deserves it. If anyone deserves it, he has worked very hard for it.
He certainly has. Justice for SBF, as our thumbnail said. Okay.
Yeah, we had a critic last week who was upset at the thumbnail that said justice for SBF, thinking that we were defending him.
Oh, really? How did they get that?
Obviously, I didn't listen to the show.
Yeah, or read the thumbnail correctly. That's okay. Okay, anyways, we got a lot of stories to go over this week. So we're going to start talking about Omni and Bitcoin. Tether is no longer supporting Omni chain. We'll start there because I want to talk about that. There's like a lot of good implications for understanding the direction Bitcoin is going based on that story. Then we're going to talk about EIP 4844, OP stack. There's some debate online about Optimism, Gitcoin Shell, Friend Tech, and maybe even some media critiques mixed up in there. So a lot of stuff to talk about. Okay, let's move over to Omni chain. Omni has been used by Tether since 2014 to move USDT Tether on top of Bitcoin. It's one of the earliest attempts at tokenization on top of Bitcoin that was commercially successful, used for quite a while. But fortunately, there's not a lot of Tether moving on top of it these days, with only about $1.4 million worth of USDT on top of it. So Tether has decided to not use it anymore. They're scaling down. They're not going to accept more USDT going onto that chain. They're going to accept, of course, people moving away from it. $1.4 million on Omni compared to $82 billion of market cap for Tether, which is mostly on top of both Ethereum and Tron. I believe Tron actually has a larger amount as of this time. So why does this matter? I'll hand it over to you for your take on this. My take on this is Bitcoin increasingly has moved away from any thoughts of having any applications on top of it. And stable coins are one of those applications that could have been like a pretty big deal for Bitcoin, like in terms of like fees and further adoption of Bitcoin. And they turned away from it. And one of the earliest protocols now is just being, you know, killed. And I think it just shows you again, people moving away from Bitcoin for any sort of application.
Well, it was a big deal on Bitcoin. So I can think back to multiple instances, like especially talking to like Web2 VCs in 2017 that were telling me that, you know, Omni was the thing that everyone was going to build on. Ethereum was dead, and which was hilarious because it was 2017. Ethereum was like, you know, very clearly not dead. All of the developers were on Ethereum. You know, but until 2019, there were still people saying that, you know, Tether was going to live on Bitcoin, and that was where to all the, you know, the majority of Tether was going to be. I don't, you know, we could actually check and see when the actual flipping of ETH, more Tether on ETH than Bitcoin was, but it, you know, it was like not as long ago as you might think, right? Like the, like for the first few years of Tether existence, there was significantly more. You know, because it actually started in like 2015, I believe, like Q1 2015. And I don't think it was until it was like late 2018 or early 2019 when it flipped and there were more ETH on that. But you can actually go to, you know, 2019 and there was still only, say, like the beginning of 2019, there was probably like $2 billion of Tether total in issuance. And really, like, you know, by the end of, you know, it spiked to like an all-time high of about where it is right now of like 80-some billion. And I think some of that like speaks to it, right? Like it wasn't ever going to be useful on Bitcoin. It was always going to be hard to use, you know, for, I would mention transaction fees because for a while they were higher on Bitcoin than Ethereum, but that's not the case anymore. But that use case moved to Tron, and you know, people definitely like, for if you want your cheaper transaction fees, use it on Tron.
Yeah, I think like looking at the numbers, looking at an old CoinDesk article from 2020, it looks like it was the beginning of 2020 when there was a flipping of Tether supplies on Omni versus Ethereum, and then since then, I believe that Tron
it was 2020. Flipping.
Yeah, it was pretty early.
Wow. So. Yeah. Yeah. Last I looked, there was more Tron issued or authorized, but not necessarily issued for Tether on Tron than Ethereum. But it is definitely, it's definitely about the same. It probably is more these days. You know, like people have, like, including me, have criticized Tron over the years for, you know, it was a copy paste, it was a fork copy paste. Like there was a lot of, you know, hilarious things, you know, lies told in marketing it. Yet it actually has a use case and people really use Tron in Argentina, in Asia. If you actually go talk to people, they, you know, it has a use case and it gets them sometimes using actual keys. Sometimes it's just custodied, but you know, so you gotta be positive on that. I don't know.
No, I'm with you on that. It's like one of those chains that like, everyone calls a scam, but there's this weird utility to it. So there's something there. Of course, Paulo in this tweet talks about how they're going to look into other Bitcoin layers or protocols to be able to continue to innovate on top of Bitcoin. So Bitfinex and Tether notably still purchase Bitcoin. Tether, especially here, is still purchasing Bitcoin. They're investing in mining. So they're still very committed to it, but I guess just Omni didn't make sense for them. So they're looking at like RGB and other places, which...
Do you think they'll actually do that?
Bitcoin thesis. I think they will. Like they have a Bitcoin thesis. I just don't. It's going to take forever. So I was looking into RGB because of this, and I've been kind of putting that off. Some of the like key developers around it is Giamacco, who's like a Bitcoin maximalist out there from Italy. Forget his last name, and then Peter Todd. The scheme for it's kind of confusing, but I mean, I'm all for developing and like seeing if something works. But at the same time, like you have two protocols right now that it works just fine. So
when is there any idea when RGB is going to be a thing?
I think it's technically live. Like you can use it. I just think it's like still pretty just early nobody in does. Terms of like no one's like actively issuing tokens on top of it. Right. It's still so small. There's some cool stuff around it. Like there's wallets and there's like some Lightning integrations possibly, but let's go talk about another subject. I thought that one was worth bringing up at the beginning of the show though, because like, there's still stuff happening on Bitcoin, but this one obviously shows you that things, legitimate projects are moving away from Bitcoin increasingly. And this is like the dying gasp of yet another project. Okay, let's move over and talk about some EIPs.
It's going to have 4844. It's probably going to happen at the end of October. I think that maybe a little less confident of that now than I was a few months ago. I actually tweeted out an over-under of, you know, it being mid to late October. Maybe I thought it would have been a little bit, like the testnets would have been a little bit more along. But devs are definitely motivated to get it over the line. We'll see if they do. If not, then we're probably looking at more like an early December launch date, just like the Beacon Chain was in December of 2020. You have seen gas fees be relatively low. And, you know, depending on what the market does, like, you know, gas fees actually got down to single digits over the last weekend. And it will be interesting to see what happens to gas fees after 4844 ships, because something like, it, you know, it's variable, right? By block and by time of day, actually. But it's something between 10 to 20x% like 20-25% of block space is used by layer twos now, like publishing their call data. And basically that's just going away because these shard blobs are going to be in a separate fee market. So all of a sudden you're going to have a bunch of empty space that, you know, can be filled. And the thing about markets like this is that when you get just a little bit of extra demand, it can wildly change the prices of gas. And I do think there is like some demand, like latent demand, which will fill some of that up. But I think it'll be interesting because I think we might also see, you know, people complain about it because, wait, like we're not burning ETH anymore. And, you know, like ETH is inflationary again. What is this? I'm very curious to see whether like some of the, you know, I don't know whether people complain about it on Twitter or whatnot, but, and I haven't seen a lot of people preparing like the community for the possibility that we could have quite low gas fees. And I don't think it's going to be a long, like a, we'll have gas fees for a long time, low gas fees for a long time period. But I think it's quite possible that it could get back down to one Gwei again, somewhat briefly, like especially over the weekend. And, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, right? Because then, you know, we're printing ETH, and that's, you know, that's what Bitcoin does.
Not good. Yeah, you're gonna have to change your tweets, man. Like, can't be comparing Bitcoin output anymore. No, there's a few notes on this for those like kind of actively wondering, like, what is this EIP about? It's basically the idea like you're separating transaction space into two parts and allowing like these L2s to settle their data on a different part of the transaction. That transaction will have a different cost, similar to what happened with Bitcoin and SegWit back in 2017, where they added a witness discount. And so you sort of had like two different costs for different transaction types. And this is important for all these L2s who are hopefully going to start adding tons of users over the next few years. This is like a transitory step towards a world where we have, you know, lots of people on L2s and we have lots of data settling to Ethereum, but not that many people using Ethereum as like their base layer. They're using an L2 in some sort of way. Another thing that was interesting to me about this was like the style of gas growth with this, which is like still an EIP 1559 style from what I understood reading like the EIP itself here. And then the last part about it was like the history of data with this. From my understanding, after like 30 days or so, all the data from these blobs is lost. And that's purposeful because Ethereum is going to become a bulletin board, as Vitalik puts it, as opposed to like this storage protocol. And they're leaning into the idea of like Ethereum losing some of this data over time. And I think that's one thing that's going to be sort of like in contention between like Bitcoiners and Ethereans over the next few years, is like how this data storage approach changes. We've seen for years now people like Tour Demeester and others kind of say that Ethereum doesn't have like full node history, or there's too much data on there. And they've been disproven.
Well, Tour didn't even understand what a full node was until a year ago, and then he finally admitted it, to his credit, after years of like understanding it and totally getting it wrong. So I actually will give him a lot of credit for finally admitting it, although, you know, he's like a few years late, but
yeah, he did admit it. But I think we're going to have like a similar showdown, right? And like in this instance, I think it's going to be a misunderstanding like what the point of this change is with the storage. I think Bitcoiners are going to look at it and be like, well, you're not like a blockchain anymore. You're not whatever you want this to be. And Ethereans are going to look at this and be like, well, that's not like the point of the protocol. Like, we're here for consensus and for, you know, putting more data on chain and then losing it, as opposed to Bitcoiners think of it the other way around. But do you have any thoughts on that? Because I feel like that's going to be a point about that in the future.
I could see Bitcoiners criticizing Ethereum for this. I sort of wonder whether they will try that hard, though, because I just think it's not really that sexy. Like, Bitcoin has a whole thing about full nodes, right? And that being a huge thing. So like there was a natural constituency for like claiming that nobody could run an Ethereum full node, when in actuality, these days, it's about as easy to run an Ethereum full node as it is to run a Bitcoin full node. There will be data that will only be out there for archive nodes, and that number will be, you know, relatively big. But I don't know. I don't think it's that big of a deal.
I think it's going to be a big deal. I honestly do.
Yeah.
I think
they just haven't realized yet, and that's why they haven't criticized it.
there's no way they know about this. I mean, there was talk back in like 2020, there's no way they know about this. I think like going back to 2020, and there was like the talk of like checkpoints and stuff like that actively in Ethereum circles, and like sometimes a Bitcoiner would be paying attention enough to Ethereum to like criticize it and like screenshot a discussion and like post that. But I think as this actually happens with blob transactions and 4844 going live, they're going to look into this and know about it after it happens and be like, oh, like they're actively deleting stuff. They're not running a full node. And that's like, that's not the point. Like they're missing it, right? They're missing like the whole development angle here. And I think it's going to be a huge deal. So if that's just my prediction, just write it down maybe and call me out in a few months. Let's talk about OP Stack this week. I'm going to hand this one off to you really quickly. So there was a lot of criticism between a few different L2 teams over this past week. And this tweet itself we have up on screen is actually from like a month or so ago from Patrick McCorry, basically talking about like the Optimism team has had a lot of growth, but they don't have like their fraud proof in order and they don't have certain things built out yet. And then there's other teams like Arbitrum and ZK Sync who are shouting at them on Twitter, and then it's back and forth. I don't fully understand this because I don't feel like I'm paying attention to this as much. Like, I think L2s are cool. I'm waiting for them to be like fully built. I understand that most of them are not fully built. I don't really understand why everyone's like chirping at each other on Twitter, but I suppose that's the purpose when you have like a token for your L2 and like you need it to go up.
Yeah, all of the rollups are piling on Optimism right now. And that's something sort of like, even, you know, Patrick says, from whatever this was, tweet was a month ago. Basically, no rollups are truly layer two yet. They are all basically still sidechains with some degree of improved security model. So, like Optimism, for example, does not have any fraud proofs on chain. And basically, everyone is piling on. And the reason why they don't have any fraud proofs, they did have fraud proofs once upon a time, about 2 years ago, a little less. But Yoav Weiss, who is sort of also the account abstraction sort of master who's spearheaded 4337, is, you know, a very smart guy. And had found a bunch of security problems just like looking around in his spare time and submitted them to Optimism. And so they got rid of their fraud proofs and has not had fraud proofs throughout basically 2022 and 2023 so far. And that doesn't sit well with a lot of people. So Arbitrum, for example, snipes at Optimism a lot, like Stephen, their CEO, Stephen Goldfeder, in particular. A lot of people take Stephen's criticisms, and he's really been active on Twitter, like criticizing them over the past week or so, but particularly in the last couple of days, and gotten a bunch of other people to pile on. And I actually don't think Stephen is doing this in a competitive sense. I think he's sort of like, you know, Arbitrum is basically all like Ed Felton's PhD students, like Stephen and Harry, and Ed is one of the co-founders as well. And I think he's just like, as an academic, he is offended that you can call yourself a roll-up but not have a fraud proof at all, right? Like, I don't even think it's a competitive thing. I think he just really, like, it just bothers him that Optimism calls themselves a roll-up. You know, I think that's a valid thing. You know, you have Alex from ZK Sync's tweet up here, which is pretty hardcore criticizing a Proto Lambda tweet. You know, and Proto's tweet says, like, you know, look, we had to build a more modular system, and that's what we've done, and we are going to be bringing back fraud proofs. And Kelvin, by the way, like, who is an Optimism OG, was a founder of Plasma Group before, which was what Optimism was before it became Optimism. Kelvin basically says, well, look, like, the security model isn't actually that different because Arbitrum, even though they now have a DAO, has a multi-sig, and that is what is functionally your security model. And so, you know, functionally, that's what Optimism's security model is too. And I think there's like a pretty good amount of, you know, like, reasonableness to that response. And the optimism folks also would say, you know, hey, like, we realize this is a problem and we are working on it. And that's what, you know, that's what Bedrock, which is the, you know, the upgrade that Proto is talking about. In the end, like, all of this goes back to what I talked about last episode, I think it was, which is there's generational wealth on the line. So, like, even though I said that's not what motivates Steven, which I, like, I 100%, like, I will reiterate, there is, you know, generational wealth on the line. They all want to win. I think from an Ethereum community standpoint, we actually don't want just one rollup to win. Like, we want healthy competition among rollups. So, like, I will 100% like reveal my bias there. I've said it before publicly. Like, I think it is much better for Ethereum if there are multiple rollups. But, you know, like, they all want more market share. They have tokens. You know, these tokens in the next bull market could be the market, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. And that's not really that unreasonable either, because these things actually make money. Like, the sequencer, like, you can go look and, you know, I'm not making this up, but I think it's under appreciated the extent to which, if you're another L1, you are paying you're inflating away your currency. Like, you know, a Sequelana has like 8% inflation or something. Maybe it's 6 or 7%, but they have a substantial monetary inflation. Whereas if you're a rollup, you don't have to do any of that. Like, you don't have to be paying all these like validators, and instead you're actually profitable. And so I do think that, like, especially as users and apps flock to rollups in the future, and the transactions are extraordinarily cheap post 4844, as we just talked about, which, you know, should happen in Q4. Like, it is going to be a game changer in terms of valuations of these things. So, you know, there's generational wealth on the line. Gonna have some popcorn perpetually, right?
Definitely gonna be some popcorn. A few things I wanted to bring up just while you're talking there is, like, there's a lack of a lot of fundamental needs for rollups. So one thing you hear about is the sequencers, right? Where it's like, we don't have decentralized sequencers. And some people are like, well, that doesn't matter at all. Why are we even like working on this? And other people are like, we really need decentralized sequencers because we're going to increase MEV possibilities. So that's not even simple. There's lots of long-winded blog posts about that if you really care to go read them. The proofs themselves, right? Fraud proofs, like, those haven't been developed yet. And from my understanding, like, no one's really built a fraud proof that works as of now. And then, like, the ZK stuff, that's moving really quickly, but it's not done yet. And I think that, well, at least the ZK team did release something somewhat recently that's, like, pretty functional. You can correct
there are
me
people,
there
by the way, that think ZK has already won and that optimistic rollups won't be a thing in a couple of years or imminently. I actually have the opposite take, which is, Arbitrum is the leader right now, but Optimism has a bunch, and like, everybody's building on the OP stack. Like, there's all these rollups that are launching, and ultimately, like, you know, what technology wins is not "quote unquote" the best, right? Air quotes.
It's the users.
Best. It's what is live and what is used, and, you know, the optimistic rollups are very much leading on that front. Like, I very, you know, basically nobody uses these ZK rollups, and it's all airdrop hunters, and there aren't really that many apps live. And I don't know, if I'm being honest, I feel like the ZK rollup business teams have been a little bit slacking in that department.
I did hear about a ZK sync airdrop in a college frat group chat I'm in, and that immediately made me question the airdrop motivations of some of the ZK teams out there. I was like, if these guys know about it, then I don't know if I want to be interacting with that chain at all.
At this point, airdrops are such a dead, boring idea for distribution. Like, you're literally just giving out your token to people that are programmatically attacking your chain. Yeah, and they're just going to dump your token. It's like, I mean, at this point, like, this is not like Uniswap. You're not Hayden. It made sense for Hayden to do for Uniswap, like Uniswap Labs. Yeah. But at this point, if you're just giving it out like blindly to users, like, it's dumb. It doesn't make any sense. And you are perpetuating bad behavior.
The one other thing I wanted to bring up was Ethereum culture. I'm glad you brought that up. You do see like this overriding difference between Bitcoin culture or Ethereum culture and just the rest of crypto, where it's like, we focus on builders. We want to be a place for builders to come and grow and go to hacker houses and get stuff paid for. Like there's Gitcoin grants, which we'll talk about in a second. There's a lot of ways to get paid to go to like all these different meetings all over the world. Like a lot of the development of Ethereum happens because of community. But you're seeing some of like the worst infighting right now between these L2s. And I have not been party to it as much because that's on my Twitter feed at the moment. But just like
it's looking entirely my Twitter feed.
Yeah. I mean, you brought it to my awareness, right? And like I was just doing some research for the show and looking through stuff. I'm like, these are some pretty cutting arguments. And I understand it because it's all about the money, but it's also very different from what I've seen in the past from Ethereum communities. Like, yes, there's been differences on protocols and ideas, and there's even been like hilarious stuff in ETH core dev calls where people had one opinion and someone else had another opinion and there was attacks there, but seems to be getting to a different level. Maybe you disagree with that, but seems to be.
Do you want to bring up this tweet I put in the chat? Alex's tweet, which you had up before, is spicy, very spicy, but low key spicy. You actually, if you are, you know, not deep in the space, you might not realize what he's saying. Like he's leaving a little bit to, you know, he's not just explicitly saying it, right? Whereas if you read this tweet, these tweets, right, like they're just going right at it. You know, like James Prestwich, who, you know, Bez says, like, you know, that's a pretty not spicy thing that he says. He's a bit of a troll. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and Proto, who is a very good developer, has an extremely good reputation for being productive and writing code, you know, writes back like, you had a large bridge fail and still bash builders about bridge changes, because Prestwich was, you know, and was one of the founders of Nomad, and that bridge was hacked for, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, look, this is just like popcorn. I mean, like I said, there's generational wealth on the line, and like people are going to fire back at each other, but you know, it can get spicy.
Yeah, the back and forth is crazy. I mean, Prestwich is always kind of in these things. And he responded, "I will give you shit for bad mouthing the people that delivered what you promised." So maybe just leave it there. I guess we'll just keep watching this. We talked about it 2 weeks in a row. It's a lot of stuff going on. Let's talk about another problem. Gitcoin and Shell. That interests you this week?
Oh boy, yeah. Gitcoin and Shell. It always surprises me how many people think that big oil is the problem with the world. And it's just this mood affiliation of
Evan
big oil
Houston,
is bad.
By the way.
Yeah, right. Although I would say I have literally zero conflicts of interest on this, outside of the fact that, like, you know, people I went to undergrad with, you know, have been, you know, 20-year lifers at all these big oil companies, all of whom, by the way, were like left-leaning Democrats when I knew them, and like I presume still are. Which is like sort of one thing I would say, right? Like, hydrocarbons are going to be pulled out of the ground. They're fundamental for literally everything that is in the world today, from plastics to technology. I mean, you know, like electronics parts and all the electricity which, you know, you use to use these electronics parts, like computers, to like your fleece vests, like literally like everything is built out of hydrocarbons, like not even just talking about, you know, gasoline and all that stuff, right? So it's literally the fundamental reality of our world is that like the modern standard of living is entirely based on oil and gas, which hydrocarbons. And so if you just want to like rag on big oil, like I get that that sounds smart to some set of people that like that. I don't even know what to say. Like there is definitely a group of people that don't understand that. And like you will, you know, you'll like virtue signaling that like that's good. But fundamentally, do you want big oil, like which has a lot of conspiracy theories about it, to be like pulling hydrocarbons out of the ground? Or do you want, you know, like somebody from a less well-off country, like say China, to be pulling them out of the ground, right? Like big oil is extremely regulated, and they can get sued. So they are like have very strong incentives and deep pockets to get this right and to do it in the most environmentally, you know, friendly way. Whereas, you know, like the less well off you are as a country is like you always just have less environmental standards. That's basically like an ironclad rule. So like, you know, you want big oil, whether it's, you know, American big oil or Shell, which is, you know, I think still UK, Dutch controlled, to be the ones that are out there pulling these out of the ground, right? Like they're going to be the most environmentally friendly thing to do.
We're sounding more and more like a Bitcoin miner on this part of the segment here. I also run a Bitcoin mining podcast, so I guess my opinions are out there. I want to get the opinion of Kevin Iwaki, who is the founder of Gitcoin, not at Gitcoin anymore, but he definitely had some opinions on this because he is a very well-known environmentalist and is actually working at something called like Greenpill, which is an environmental group. He was not particularly pleased with Gitcoin, which is now a DAO working with Shell. And he went as far in this tweet to say that the Gitcoin team and whoever put this together with Shell undid a lot of the branding work that the team had done last cycle. So he was pretty unhappy with it. He did soften it at the end a little bit and say like, hey, this is a DAO. Anyone can bring this in. We're going to like keep our eyes open for like maybe there's a potential benefit out of here. But for the most part, like his whole opinion on this was pretty negative, even calling for the grant to Gitcoin should be higher and should be viewed as war reparations as opposed to an open source developer grant, which I thought was a little silly, but that's his opinion. So it's okay. He can take it as he wants. I think the bigger thing here to me is like the greenwashing is important. Like greenwashing anything is really stupid and I'm against it. And I'm against like these oil companies pretending that they're not in the business of like extracting oil from the ground. Like that's what you're doing. On the other side, it does make sense for them to be collaborating with people who are going to help them transition their businesses. Like we're not always going to be in an oil and gas standard. We're going to be doing something else. So you know, the fact that they can't spend R&D money trying to move to something else is a little ridiculous. And if they're spending it with Gitcoin, what's wrong with that?
So BP and Shell are, to be fair, the ones that are like known for being, you know, spending like they do all the PR about not really being oil companies. And anyway, like, I think it's stupid because it doesn't work. It's just a waste of money on their part. Like, because like people like this, you know, like people out there, like you've seen it in crypto, like they can't delineate the fact that Shell has a different take on this than any other big oil company, right? So, and BP and Shell have been, you know, I don't have numbers on this. I haven't checked in a little bit, but historically they were sort of like the people that put more money into green energy, whatever, you know, that big umbrella, which by the way, has been happening, like all those has been happening for decades. The thing is, it's just never been economical. And a lot of times these big oil companies were basically forced to do it by politicians to blow money on this stuff. You know, we're finally getting to the point where some of it makes sense. I mean, solar now makes sense, wind now makes sense, but you know, like, you know, you can go back like many, many decades and it did not make sense. They wasted money on it anyway.
Okay. Let's sunset that part of the conversation. Let's go talk about friend.tech. It's just like your thing, right? Your friend booted this up. I kind of saw this as like BitClout 2.0, but on Ethereum and maybe a healthier version. But BitClout was launched in 2021. It was an idea that you can create shares or dollar denominated value of a person through social media. So say you are Kim Kardashian, you can log into BitClout. They've created an account for you and they've assigned some sort of dollar values to your internet shares. And you have some amount of shares for your profile and people can go and buy those shares. And through like the scheme they had, basically it was like up only. From my understanding, it was kind of hard to cash out on this whole program. After a while, people got pretty upset with this. It tried to transition to a layer one blockchain called like Demos or something like that.
Kind of
fluttered out. DSO, you're right. DSO. It fluttered out and no one really cared about it after a while, but it did piss off a lot of people in crypto community. One, because like the security around it was really bad. Two, it was leaking a lot of private information. And three, it's like a social media gimmick in a way. And I think there was a lot of concerns around like who's actually getting the benefit of this. No one's really talked about it since 2021, but it was definitely like a thing in the crypto discourse, if you will, for a little bit there. And then no one really touched it for a while. There was a lot of different like Web3 social media ideas that popped up in between. And now we return to the same thing as BitClout, but with friend.tech on Ethereum. And it seems like this one is BitClout with less teeth. Like this is BitClout as a project that is less about engrossing the founders and more about just kind of experimenting with monetizing your social media profile.
Yeah. BitClout also was shielded heavily by Silicon Valley VCs,
yes. including A16Z was like an investor in it, right?
Yeah, probably as well. It really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Also, I think at one point they were asking you to put your Bitcoin private keys into the browser. So,
yes,
you know, and then you would be there whether you signed up at all. Your Twitter account would be there whether you had signed up for this. Like, there was no opt-in. And that really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. There might have been some opt-out, but again, like, maybe you even had to like put, you know, you had to like do active work, which, you know, like, I didn't want to interact with their software. So I never opted out, despite feeling like I didn't want to be there. Friend.tech is kind of like BitClout. It is sort of like you go on, you create a meme coin, like your Twitter account, like is like you go in and you authorize your Twitter account and it creates a share of your thing. And so then people can like speculate on it. What I would say is, it's a very, so one, it's a progressive web app, a PWA, or a phone web app, some people call it. So you install it on your phone and it is on your phone, and you like, it creates a key that lives on your phone, and it's on Base. So the fees are quite cheap, and it is like you're sort of gambling on your, on people's Twitter accounts and whether more people will buy it. But what's cool about it, like outside of like, maybe I didn't do a great job of describing why it was a better UX, but like it's a pretty good UX, is there is an actual intrinsic value to this meme coin, right? So I would say like my definition of meme coin has intrinsic value or not. So I would say not really a meme coin, because you get a group chat with the person in the Twitter account, right? So if you buy my shares, there's a group chat that I'm in and I pay attention to it, like I think most people do. Even though like most people don't have more than 10 holders. I mean, there's a lot of like, you know, buying and selling and people speculating on it. And so you can see that this is like, you know, an evolution of something that will be something someday. It could be something. You know, there's a lot of criticisms of that. Should we get into that now?
Let's do the criticisms.
The founder is Racer. So founder is definitely like, Racer is definitely, you know, to go back to our interview with Austin Griffith, right? He said like the value of tinkering. And I'd say that Racer has like released a bunch of stuff, and I've heard some people criticize him for it, but Racer has tinkered, did Steelcam, which I think Racer is now, you know, switched to doing the focus to doing friend tech. And so like, you know, it's possible that this won't, you know, be a thing that is maintained long term. This could just be a flavor of the month, but I think it's like very well executed in terms of the virality of the marketing. It's fun to use. It is relatively easy and cheap, so like mainstream audiences can do it. You know, all you really need is a little bit of ETH. It's also, you know, it's a little bit low stakes. Like the entire, like, well, the price just went down a lot, but it was about $2 million. Now it's probably like $1.5 million. But, you know, so like, and that's of the entire, right, everybody that's using the app right now. So I put $200 into it. I actually, you earn when people shell, like I think I make like $1.40 every time somebody buys or sells a share of my thing. And so, you know, like you want people buying and selling your shares, right? Like that's, you know, cause you're earning a little bit. So anyway, yeah, it's just cool. Like it's a fun app to use. You can see it being like useful, like something that mainstream wants to do. Yes, there's a speculative element. Like I definitely would not like, you know, disagree with that by any means. But I also think you can see this evolving to be like the, like something that actually like, you know, is a breakout, like a killer app or something like that, where it, you know, influencers or whoever it is willing to like, you know, hang out with their, you know, because it's gated, right? You have to buy into this thing. And, you know, people like celebrity culture ain't going away, right? Like people love this stuff.
Do you think people should actually use this, or is this just like the next thing that's going to be here for like 2 weeks and then just gone?
I don't know. So I think you should try it out. I don't think you should necessarily put a lot of ETH into it. and I don't think a lot of people have. Some of the shares, I don't know what my shares are worth right now, but they're probably $80. So, you know, it's not crazy, right, to like be able to message somebody for $80. Like if I could message Bukayo Saka for $80, like he's a player on Arsenal, like I might do it. But there is an issue right now, which is that because this is all on a blockchain, it's not exactly MEV, but I'm pretty sure it's all the MEV people. They, as soon as anybody creates the first share, like as soon as that Twitter account signs up, they just buy a ton of those shares. And then as soon as other people buy, because the app exposes in the user interface to everybody that they just signed up, but it doesn't show all the trades that happen on chain, but not in the interface, right? And so that's actually something that Racer really needs to improve, because like right now, like you're basically competing against, you know, professional traders, and it's, you know, more or less not possible to make money. So
it's not a money making engine, but there is that cool part about like being able to talk to somebody otherwise you wouldn't have the ability to interact with, which I think does have some like value. So I saw someone talking about how like this is like Cameo for crypto at this point, where like if you want to go talk to Kobe, maybe you can talk to him by having a share in his friend.tech. The one thing I want to bring up really quickly here is the Dune Analytics dashboard we have up. And for those just listening, this is a Dune Analytics dashboard that looks at Ethereum NFTs and friend.tech since the launch of friend.tech. And so this is looking at total transactions, number of unique buyers, and volume. Asterisk on all this, crypto data is hard, so it can be incorrect. But friend.tech had 300,000 total transactions, about 30,000 unique buyers, and $14 million in volume. While ETH NFTs had 51,000 total transactions, 23,000 unique buyers, and 34 million in USD volume over the same period. So we see like way more transactions and slightly higher unique buyers over the period for friend.tech. I don't think that's like super instructive for right now, besides just kind of showing you like, you know, there's probably 30,000 unique people in crypto right now who are like interested in doing something like this. But like if this continues over a long term and you see people like continue to do this, that's like, yeah, I think like your point stands pretty well. Like there could be something here. Okay, we have to close on this news. We know why Bitcoin is going down. SpaceX sold $373 million worth of Bitcoin, according to the Wall Street Journal. I came out while we're recording this. So there you go. That's why it's all going down, man.
Elon dumped. I didn't realize he had bought through SpaceX too. I thought he had only bought through Tesla.
That be what it is. They're dumping the Bitcoin. So is that like bottom, right? Is that the bottom right there? Or did we hit the bottom last year at FTX? Or is that the catalyst of the bottom?
Look, I am long-term quite bullish on, you know, ETH and Ethereum, but I don't know. I don't really know what the narrative is right now that brings new money in, like quite frankly. I, you know, think about just the past and whatever, you know, like if you're a Bitcoiner, like the halving is the hopium, right? But, you know, that's not for another year. If you're, you know, whatever it is, like, I don't know what any narrative brings people into the space right now. And, you know, Bitcoin still has a crazy amount of miners that need to be paid for. And like that issuance is, you know, very substantial. So, you know, the natural state of Bitcoin is a commodity. So commodities, it's very well studied in finance. They tend to have long slopes downward. And then when demand outpaces supply, there are short, violent spikes. And then you go back to the long slope downward. And that's all of commodity prices. And Bitcoin very much trades like that and always has, I would say. Like you can go look, right? Like there's this speculative furor and that's the demand outpacing supply and it goes up like crazy. And then there's a long slope back down and then until the next spike. You know, I thought that maybe with ETH now being, you know, negative issuance or deflationary, as I guess is sort of the Bitcoin nomenclature, I would have thought that might have changed that. But, you know, BTC and ETH are extremely coupled together right now. So, you know, anything that causes one to sell off causes the other to sell off.
No, like I agree with you. I think like they're super coupled. We're seeing it right now. Like both went down 10% right after we have the Bitcoin news. And so that hasn't really changed too much. I think like we just get really stuck in Twitter and like we see like the development use cases going different ways. Ethereum continues to like add things for more purposes. Bitcoin is like still stuck on like this Bitcoin as money idea. And you know, maybe they both work on their dough in different ways, but like in the minds of a fund manager, whoever is buying and selling the stuff, it's the same thing. So I think that's just going to continue to happen. I think the mining stuff can get overplayed a little bit because these miners, like they're not, there is a lot of Bitcoin mined per day and like over a monthly period, and like it can affect things. But in terms of like the Bitcoin traded volume, if you aggregate like OTC desks and then exchanges and trading hands, like it kind of dwarfs what is actually mined and then sold on the open market. I think like Bitcoin miners are in a more precarious position than ever. They're often just funded by public money and they are tied to this commodity, which can be extremely violent as we've seen like right now. So they're in a tough spot and that makes the economics kind of whack. But yeah, my market take is still the same and it's happening right now. I said September was going to be bad. We're getting a jump start on it. It's middle of August and it's already occurring.
We need narrative. I mean, you know, like this is, it's literally something that, you know, it is. It goes up and down with flows just like anything else. And like right now, the narrative is still bad and there's still some toxic leverage. And there's, you know, I mean, frankly, miners, they, like you said, like they do have some, you know, leeway into when they have to sell, but that, you know, that also can be bad because it can force some selling as well. So I don't know. I don't see anything over, we did say what we were going to be over the time frame, and so we've said bearish, but we didn't say time frame. And I think we should establish a standard time frame, like 3 months.
I think 3 months. It's August 17th. I think I'm bearish going until bottom, until Christmas. New year, new me. Bitcoin up only after January. ETH up only. That's my take.
Yeah, we'll see. It also macro depends some, and I think macro is not going to be good either. So,
yeah.
No.
Doomerism on the podcast. Okay, we'll cut it there. Thank you for listening to the Web3 podcast. This is the news edition. We'll have interviews coming up in the near future, including someone named Vitalik. He hasn't been on too many podcasts, I've heard, so I'm going to get him on here. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe to us on YouTube. Give us a 5-star on your RSS podcasting platform of choice. That helps other people find us. And there's some giveaways going on, so maybe jump into those. Talk to you guys next week.